If you'd like to follow along, the scripture reading before Ryan brings his lesson will be from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and it will be verses 11 and 12. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall.
If you're visiting with us for the very first time, then we're very encouraged by your presence. We certainly would love to get to know you a little bit better and find out what spiritual needs you might have while you're here in our company. If there's anything that we can do to help you out, any questions that you have about our worship or about the Bible, then we'd love to sit down and answer those questions for you. I'm very grateful for our members who are here. I'm grateful for those who are tuning into our live stream. It's just so nice to know that we're staying engaged and that we're staying encouraged. And I certainly am encouraged by your presence here today. So keep your Bibles open to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. That's going to be our first scripture that we take a look at this morning here in just a few moments. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verses 11 and 12. That's going to be our main passage for the day. As we get going here, I'll start by saying this. We all serve as examples. Some of us are good examples and some of us are bad examples. Some of us are role models and others end up being cautionary tales. We are all examples to somebody in some way. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves as we proceed into this lesson is, what kind of example are you going to be? And that's why he says here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Now, we know earlier in the chapter, the Apostle Paul is talking about the example of the Israelites in the wilderness, and how unfaithful they had been from time to time to time in their interaction with God. Many of them, if not all of them except for Joshua and Caleb, perished in the wilderness after they left the Red Sea. In 40 years from that generation that left Egypt and crossed the Red Sea, only two of that generation, two of the adult men who left Egypt, made it to the promised land. That is an incredible display of unfaithfulness. You know, we can't get too cocky. We can't be too arrogant. And that's exactly the point that he's making here is, you can look at the example of the utter spiritual failure of Israel in the wilderness, and maybe you can feel a little good about yourself. Well, I'm not nearly that bad. I'm not nearly that bad. But be careful. Take heed, lest you fall. This phrase that he uses, take heed, Paul clearly means for his readers to very carefully consider the spiritual demise of other people. Now, this doesn't mean that we need to revel in somebody else's spiritual demise. It doesn't mean that we kick someone when he's down. It doesn't mean that we are supposed to find humor in another person's pain or eternal condemnation. That's not the point of taking heed. And I'm afraid that we do that sometimes. We do that with other people in our lives as well. We revel when our enemies fail somehow. It's so satisfying at the end of a movie when the villain gets his comeuppance. It's so satisfying to us to see that justice has been served. But did we take the example to heart? Take heed. Again, it doesn't mean reveling in it or thinking that it's funny, but you do need to watch and listen and take note of what happens to people in the Bible when their sins come around and defeat them. And it's not as if we're lacking examples in the Bible either. The Bible's filled with many ups and downs, including the vices and the victories of even the greatest heroes of faith. Maybe it was because he did not take heed that Abraham still sinned, or that Moses still sinned, that Gideon sinned, that David and Peter and even Paul himself committed sins. All of them committed sins. And all of them serve as examples. I also think it's valuable to look at the examples of those that are closer to home. To not just look at folks in the Bible, but also to look at those who are in my life. Here's one thing that I notice, at least in my life, and perhaps you can sympathize with this, that sometimes I read about characters in the Bible, and they lived in a different era, they had very different customs and cultures, they're on the other side of the world from where I live, and it can be very easy to take examples like Abraham, Moses, Gideon, David, and Peter, and keep them at arm's length. They're in the abstract. And so we see these Bible characters as being from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago in a completely different place, and I can kind of keep them at arm's length. And I don't really have to look at David and see myself in David. I don't have to look at Peter and see myself in Peter, because their circumstances and their time period are so different from my own. So I do think that there's value in looking at the examples from my own life and taking heed. And sadly, every single one of us in this room can look back on our lives and remember the friends or the family members, the church members who have gone astray in their walk with God. We can all look back on the family members who fell deeply into some kind of sexual sin and paid the ultimate consequence for it. I can think about in my own life the family members that I have known that have been lost to sin. Now, I don't revel in it. I don't laugh about it. I don't indulge in it. But I'm supposed to take heed to those who fall. I'm supposed to look at the people in my life who have fallen and learn something from that. And that's what I said at the beginning of the lesson. Everybody is an example. You're either going to be a role model to somebody, or you're going to be a cautionary tale to somebody else. And I need to take heed to that. And whether you like it or not, you're going to be an example. And you need to listen to that. But he also says, lest you fall. I often wonder what it would be like to fall and what it would take for me to fall. Now, I don't mean that we need to sit and fantasize about it. We don't need to indulge our imaginations and go, I wonder what it would take for me to have an affair and cheat on my wife. Or I wonder what it would take for me to finally, like, let the road rage have its way and, like, run someone off the freeway into a ditch. Like, I'm not saying that we need to sit there and indulge our fantasies about what it would be like to finally, like, fall off the rails and do all the stuff we've wanted to do. I just mean, I think it's important to take time in your life to think about where you are spiritually and morally and consider in a very sober way, what would it take for me to fall? What circumstance would have to exist in my life that conceivably, realistically could happen to me to where I would cheat on my spouse? Or I would become a pornography addict. Or I would kill somebody. Or steal from somebody. Or commit fraud of some kind. What would it take for me to fall? Take heed, he says, lest you fall. I am humbled by the fact that many marriages fall apart, and I have witnessed them fall apart. Marriages that at some point were just as happy as mine. I'm humbled by the fact that many preachers who have fallen into false teaching at some point held the same views as me. I'm humbled by the fact that many fathers who've abandoned their responsibilities at some point probably adored their children as much as I do. Countless people who have professed belief, who looked the part, who served as elders or deacons, who taught Bible classes, who had great attendance, who wore the name of Christ, are now godless, sexually indulgent, alcoholics, or addicts, or sinners of any kind. It humbles me when I look at the examples from my own family, my own churches, my own experiences, and go, I'm not that different from him. At some point, he loved his wife too. At some point, he loved his children. At some point, he was here every Sunday. And now, he's not. And if I'm not careful, I'm not that much different. Take heed to the examples, lest you fall also. My friends, if Satan demanded permission to sift Peter like wheat and really believed that he had a shot at knocking down an apostle, then we cannot imagine that we're so smart and so strong and so faithful that we won't end up in Satan's scope at some point as well. Satan looked at Peter the apostle and said, I think I can get him. He looked at Peter and thought Peter had a realistic shot at falling away from Jesus Christ. Don't think for a moment that you're that much stronger than Peter was when he fell. So what I want to do then is ask this question, why do we fall off the edge of the cliff? And look at an example from 2 Samuel chapter 11. I'm sure you're very familiar with the story. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, the chapter begins with this statement that it happened in the springtime that at the time when kings go out to battle, that King David sent Joab instead. But David stayed behind in Jerusalem. David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Now, again, if you're familiar at all with the story of David, you know where this is going. Because in the very next verse, in the ongoing verses, David witnesses in the middle of the night from his own rooftop. And of course, the home of David was up on a hill, and so he could basically look down and see most of the city of Jerusalem below him. And from his own rooftop, he could observe a woman bathing on her rooftop. And instead of turning away, he looked a little longer and lingered over the image. And then he investigated about who's the woman that lives in that house down the street down there. And then he invited her over, whether it was by her choice or by force. I don't know if it's real clear from the story. But he brought her over and had his way with her. The woman ends up getting pregnant. And in a panic, David tries to find some way of covering up his sins. He gets a righteous man drunk and eventually sends the man to his death. And so after lust and adultery and deceit and murder, we see the story of David take a drastic turn. Why do we fall off the cliff? Why do we go from David, a man after God's own heart, to lust, adultery, deceit, and murder? I mean, that's a pretty awful list, isn't it? I honestly, and I'm not saying I'm better than David here, but like when I look at my life, I don't think in one story that I've committed all of those things all in one story. That's a pretty horrific event in David's life. And we know the result of it, of course. The result is heartache for him and his family, trouble with his children from that point onward. His life was made more difficult because of this sin that he committed. How do we fall off the cliff, though? How do we go from that, David, a man after God's own heart, to that sinful situation? Of course, we could always say there are things David should have done differently the whole time. After the very first look, he should have averted his gaze and found something else to look at. We know that. But I think every step of the way, you can read that story, and every single step of the way, David had an opportunity to turn the story around. There was no point of no return until he actually came to the end of it all. And I think we need to be really careful about that in our own lives as well. Like there, you are given plenty of opportunities along the way to turn things around. Like you don't just wake up one day and then it is like that. Sin tends to be a very progressive thing in our lives, and I think we're given plenty of opportunities, just as David was, to turn the ship around. Which leads to our next point. that it is often very, very small steps that lead to our demise. It's not just one giant step, right? Ryan Goodwin is not going to just wake up one day and say, you know what? That's it. I'm done. I'm going to drink and I'm going to gamble and I'm going to leave Rebecca and the kids and I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to murder someone today and I'm going to run someone off the road. Give me the Ten Commandments. I'm going to check every one of them off today. I got to start living and make up for lost time. I think sin gets into our lives by small progressive steps. It's an incremental thing where it's one failure over here, another failure over here, a compromise in this part of our life that leads to a greater compromise the next time that sin faces us. It's a little temptation after a little temptation after a little temptation. Sin is progressive. Sin is clever. So what are some of the small steps that we see in our lives that may be an indication that we're becoming unfaithful to the Lord and falling off the cliff into sin? Let me give you a few examples here just by way of practical application to consider. The first one is this. Ask yourself, how am I dressing? You might be wondering, well, what does that have to do with it? What do clothes have to do with any of it? I can wear any clothes that I want. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm murdering someone or committing adultery or anything like that. I do think clothes, though, oftentimes, not always, I understand there are exceptions. I'm not going to make some kind of blanket statement about your clothes. But I think clothes oftentimes are a superficial indicator of something else that's going on the inside. I think they are an outward manifestation of some kind of spiritual corruption that's happening on the inside. We often dress in a way that represents what our priorities are. If our priorities are to show off the body, if our priorities are to show off how successful we are, if our priorities are to show off how much richer I am than you, if our priorities are to show off how rebellious I am, how risque I am, how strong I am, how intimidating I am, guess what? Your clothes almost always are going to reflect what that priority is. And if you want people to think that you're scary, or you want people to think that you're sexy, or you want people to think that you're rich and snooty, you're probably going to dress like it. Now, not always. And again, I don't want to make a blanket statement as if it's always the case, but I think it's important for us to ask, as we're going through this spiritual walk of life, how am I dressing, and is it a reflection of a good spiritual direction or a bad spiritual direction? Because unfortunately, when we dress in a way that represents sin, our actions eventually follow. But here's another question to ask yourself. How am I spending my time? Am I making excuses for poor worship? Am I too busy for prayer, for study, or for other spiritual disciplines? Because I think spiritual failure starts with being too busy for the right things. You know, one day I'm too busy for this activity, and I'm too busy for this activity, and I'm too busy for this activity. And when you believe that you're too busy for the really important things in life, don't be shocked one day if they stop being really important things to you. And so ask yourself, how am I spending my time? Am I rationalizing my sins? When I take a look, when I take a spiritual test, right, a self-test, and I take a look at how I'm living and what I'm doing, do I come up with, like, you know, clever euphemisms for my behavior? Am I trying to sanitize my sins by calling them something that they're not? Let me give you a few examples. We make excuses for lust, and we just call it, I'm flirtatious. Right? I'm a naturally flirtatious person. It's not that I'm a lustful person or that I'm a sensual person. I'm just flirtatious. That's just my natural personality, is to be flirtatious. We call it social drinking rather than drunkenness. We call it living together rather than fornication. We try to come up with some sanitized, pleasant way of describing sin so that we don't actually have to call it sin. I mean, call it whatever you want, a midlife crisis if you feel like it, but oftentimes a midlife crisis is just a euphemism for a really major spiritual disaster around the next bend.
I like what it says in Isaiah 5 and verse 20. The prophet says there, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Sin is sin. And just because you call it something else doesn't mean it stops being sin. Just because you put a nice friendly label on it doesn't mean it's not sin. My friends, falling away is a process that begins in the heart. When one piece of resolve, one bit of conviction is weakened or whittled away in some way, look at the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 3, referring to the very same people as 1 Corinthians 10, the Israelites in the wilderness, this was the commentary that the writer of Hebrews had to add to this conversation. In Hebrews chapter 3, he talks about those who fell in the wilderness, those who were lost to the sands of time in the middle of nowhere. Why? Because of their unfaithfulness, he says. It says in verse 12, Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12, "Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, an unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. Encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end." And he concludes the chapter in verse 19 by saying, "And so we see that they were not able to enter into the rest. They were not able to enter into the land of Canaan, the promised land." Why? Not because of some insurmountable physical obstacle. Do you know why they didn't enter the land of rest? Because of their unbelief. Because it started in the heart. They stopped believing. And when you stop believing, you start sinning. And I hope that these verses, especially verses 12 through 14, make a lot of sense to you and that you see the application of them. I hope that in this lesson today, we're actually doing this. That we are taking care lest any one of you should fall because of an evil and unbelieving heart. I'll get personal here for just a sec. Reveal a little bit of what goes on in Preacher Ryan's heart. I know that it's easy, like, when you've got this level of separation as a preacher, right? I'm up here and you're sitting down there and I'm up on a stage and I've even got ridiculous plexiglass separation between us. And I know that people talk about, like, preachers live in a glass house and preachers aren't blah, 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 and all that stuff. I absolutely love every single one of you. And I have loved every single member of every church I've ever preached for. I love people. People are awesome, and God's people are the best people of all. And I absolutely love you. And I'm sick and tired after 17 years of being a preacher. I am sick and tired of waking up one day to a phone call or a text from the elder saying, "You will not believe what's happening in so-and-so's life. You will not believe that that marriage, that couple that you looked up to, that couple that you thought was a role model, that you always thought, they love each other so much, they're so happy together. Ryan, we need to talk to you about what's going on in their life. So-and-so's having an affair, and he's left his family, and he's left the church, and he doesn't want to have a part of any of us anymore." And honestly, I think most of us, if you've been a Christian long enough, you can say the same story, can't you? So-and-so who was a deacon, so-and-so who was a role model, so-and-so who you never thought Satan could get his talons on him, he's fallen away. Just a couple weeks ago, Rebecca and I found out that a couple that we knew from a previous congregation, a couple that we really adored, people that we really looked up to. They were about 10 years older than us, and they were kind of, they're that couple that we always viewed as they're in the next stage, right? They're in the very next stage after us. So everything they're doing, we're going to follow them in about 10 years. And it was just so great to get to know them as a couple. And he left his wife, and he's got himself a beautiful midlife crisis on his Facebook page. And he doesn't want to have anything to do with the church anymore. And he says, "Christianity is all fake. It's pointless. I've been wasting my time all these years. It's time to finally start living. And I'm sick and tired of stories like that. And so I'm preaching verse 13. Encourage one another day after day, as long as it's still called today, lest any one of you or me should be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. And I don't want any of those stories. I don't want to hear that story again. It hurts me. And it hurts our elders, and I know it hurts you. So let's encourage each other. Let's encourage each other. As we bring our lesson to a close, I want to consider just a couple of warning signs in your own life that maybe bring it even closer to home for you. And some of these might touch you in a way that is a little bit too raw, and I get that. There's really no convenient time to talk about a lesson like this. And I could wait a year to talk about this lesson. I could wait 6 months, and there's always going to be folks who a sermon like this is going to hit them a little close to home. And I understand that, and I don't want to be insensitive if that's something that you're going through in your own life. If you're the victim of somebody else's sinful behavior, or if you're somebody who's currently recovering from the sins that you've committed, that you're getting through the consequences, you're living through those consequences, you're trying to get to the other side, I don't want to seem insensitive at all in any of these applications that I bring up. But they need to be talked about so that they're before our eyes and we can think about them. And hopefully, stem the sin before it really ruins us. First one is this. Be very, very careful when you become somebody else's confidant. And that's not a word that you're familiar with. A confidant is somebody that you're able to share all of your secrets with. You're able to go to somebody and you're able to tell them all of your deepest, darkest secrets, the things you don't want anybody else to know. Be careful about becoming somebody else's confidant, because there's a very unhealthy level of involvement that can happen when you start listening to everybody's complaints about their marriage, about their kids, about their career, about their life, about somebody at church. Be very careful. And when somebody wants you to be their confidant, they say, Ryan, I want to get some stuff off my chest. You know what I always say? I open up Matthew 18 and I say, before you say anything to me, did you talk to the person already? Have you talked to that person face to face, one on one, before you say another word to me about whatever problem you've got with your wife, with your kids, with someone else? Have you talked to that person about these things before you talk to me about it? Watch out for becoming somebody's confidant, because it's not a big leap. It really isn't. It's not a big leap from going from someone's confidant to somebody's lover. It's not a big leap. Usually when people are asking you to be their confidant, they're really just looking for someone to complain to, not to necessarily find solutions or to lead to repentance. The flip side of that, of course, is when you are the one who is seeking the confidant, when you're seeking sympathetic ears. And I cannot count the number of once faithful Christians who now base their definitions of right and wrong on the opinions and morals of those who already agree with them. Let me say that again. I cannot count the number of times that once faithful Christians, people who have fallen away, now define right and wrong based solely on what everyone is already telling them, of what they already want to believe, of the yes men in their lives who will just confirm in their thinking that they've made the right choice. That when you go off the rails spiritually and you want to start really living and making up for lost time, there are worldly friends out there who will say, you go, girl! You go for it! You do you! Hey, you don't need that kind of negativity in your life. I'll tell you what, the world will provide you ample cheerleaders. If you want to fall headlong into sin, the world will provide you ample cheerleaders to make you think that you're making the right choice on that. It reminds me very much of 1 Kings chapter 12, where Rehoboam, he could listen to his father's advisors, the old stodgy men, or he could listen to the young people who were in his generation, and all the young people told him, you do you, Rehoboam. You don't need that kind of negativity. You do you. Watch out for compliments. One woman wrote in a book called The Snare. She said, when I was in a loving marriage relationship, I could never understand what drove people to immorality. Now that I've spent years alone, I better understand what it means to be famished. What we must recognize is that selling our birthright, our soul, for mere stew, which is the false intimacy of sin, is never the answer. You know, the reason why some people want compliments is because they're starving. They're starving because of a husband or wife who won't give them attention. They're starving because they feel unappreciated in their life. They're starving. And so they'll take compliments from anybody, including abusers. They'll take compliments from anybody, including predators. Because they're starving for love and affection and attention, because they're starving for somebody to care about them, they will take compliments from anybody. The book of Proverbs says in Proverbs 27, verse 7, a sated man or a satisfied man loathes honey, but to a starving man, any bitter thing seems sweet. I think that leads us to fall headlong into sin because we're so starved for attention or love or affection that we'll take anything. We'll take anything at that point. There's the stare, the touch, the free sample. You see that in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 25. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. You know, I may be rationalizing my sin by degrees. I may believe that my sin, I'm only going to take it just this far, right? I'll go this far, but nothing more. I won't take it any further than that. But Satan is the ultimate salesman. Satan hooks his victims with free samples. Satan says, I'm not telling you to become an axe murderer or anything, but why don't you try anger on for size? Because, boy, anger sure feels good. I'm not telling you to become some kind of nasty polygamist here, but a man's got to get what a man needs. Satan is the ultimate salesman, and he'll hook you in with the free samples. The little touch here, the little look there, sneaking a little something here and there. And the last point is this. I think we fall headlong into sin, and we allow others to do so as well, when we are naive about our loved ones. Many relationships become mundane. We get used to our spouse. We lose the electricity that we once had. We take friends for granted. We assume that our children will always listen to us and always respect us and always take our word as gospel. And when this happens, we stop giving the people that we love most the attention that they crave. We assume that everybody else perceives our loved ones the way that we do. We forget that our spouse may actually be quite attractive to somebody else. In a way, and I'm careful to say this, but in a way, I think that I need to constantly be fighting for Rebecca. Not that I believe our marriage is so tenuous that if I give up for a moment that she'll just fall away, but I need to view Rebecca as, I need to earn that love every day. Constantly fighting for that marriage, constantly fighting for unity in our relationship. Because when I start letting go, when I start letting her slip away, that's when the predators come in. I got to do the same thing with my children. Because if I don't love my children, and I don't want to get real raw here, I know we need to be careful about the language that we use, but if I don't love my children, there's plenty of nasty people out there who would love to love my children. And they won't love them in the way I would. If I am naive about my loved ones, there are plenty of predators out there who will take advantage of that weakness of mine. There's an entire world of sin that my children and my wife and myself and you, my friends and my brothers and sisters have to face. And we cannot be naive about that. Now, if you are not a Christian here this morning, then you really ought to be. You have an opportunity right now to make things right with God, to give your life over to Him by listening to the message of the gospel, which so simply, in Mark 16:16 says, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So whatever spiritual need you have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.